You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or a contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for April 29th, 2016. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from deep inside Paul Ryan's incurable pre-existing condition of being Republican. It's the Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Oh my goodness, Paul Ryan.
I'm a healthcare expert now. Yay! He took a pill. Overnight, he became a healthcare expert. And now he will share his great ideas with many
He's
of us.
He's got a big new healthcare idea. He's going to have it ready for the Cleveland Convention.
That's awesome. That is so awesome.
Wait. It's high-risk pools.
Oh. Yeah, we don't go to that pool anymore. they closed that down years ago. It's very unsafe, apparently.
The high-risk pools that didn't work back in 2010.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. It's called not taking care of seriously sick people.
Yeah, it's very simple. If you begin your health insurance model with let's dump everyone who is possibly going to cost us money,
mm-hmm.
well, then you have the old healthcare system.
Yeah.
So way to go, Paul Ryan. You have brought back essentially the way the healthcare system has been operating for years before Obamacare came along and ruined everything. I was listening to him on the radio device briefly as I was gallivanting about town today, and I was yelling at my radio because that's what you do. I don't really yell. I just sort of debate with my radio. I always win because at some point I just turn it off and declare victory and go away. But it really is just hilarious how even Paul Ryan believes history began in January of 2000.
Oh, yeah.
The past seven years, the healthcare system. It's like, okay. And again, the reason we have a mainstream media, the purpose of the mainstream media is to make sure nobody asks Paul Ryan, hey, Paul, what happened before 2009?
Mm-hmm.
Remember when you and President Romney thought that maybe the best possible thing we could do for the auto industry is let them burn?
Yeah.
Remember how you're going to let the whole auto industry crash and burn? And the reason I brought that up is I loaned one of my articles to some writing group, and they're having a discussion and et cetera, around it. But I was advised by the person who I loaned it to, who asked very nicely, that I should come and, you know, get involved in the comments, because that's how you raise awareness of your writing. And I just wanted to kind of mm-hmm. laugh.
For free. I take it this was for free.
Yeah, for free. Okay. Oh, they wouldn't charge me a fee for this, which I think is damn nice.
To come and participate in their website.
Yeah, I'm apparently a high-risk pool member, the high-risk blogging pool. So they were willing to put my post up and have their people piss on it, which is great.
right.
But right out of the box comes the both siderists. Unprompted by me in a writer's group that I've never heard of before, right out of the box comes, you know, both parties are so screwed up and dysfunctional. It's just that they're both beyond salvation. They're both beyond logic. And I just, in my head, because I can't stop myself anymore,
mm-hmm.
I'm getting better, started making a list of all the things that
both sides don't.
That both sides, and let's start with the auto industry. Just pick up any point in the calendar over the last 30 years, you can put a pin on it and find some issue the Republicans were dead-ass wrong about and liberals were right about.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're going to get to John Boehner losing his shit in a little while.
Yeah, in a few minutes. But I did want to just go back to this high-risk pool thing with Paul Ryan, because this is the problem with Obamacare for the insurance industry, is they don't want to cover seriously sick people.
Why, Blue Gal? Why?
Because it bites into their profit.
Oh, that's right. It costs them money. Yes, there's no way to make a profit on really sick people.
Yeah.
There's no way to make a profit on poor people.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So, well, and the poor people if your state expanded Medicaid, the poor people have Medicaid. I mean, that's supposedly the working poor have Medicaid.
They have some form of subsidized health care.
Yeah, health insurance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think health care and health insurance get too often covered over one another. And if you're closing Planned Parenthood clinics, you're not providing health care for a lot of people.
Exactly.
So it's important to recognize we're talking about insurance, which for a lot of people is not affordable mm-hmm. still. But this high risk pool thing really is something that was considered back in 2010. And it doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. The money burns out immediately because you're dealing with people that have severe diabetes and blindness from diabetes and are losing their feet because of diabetes and they're losing, or they have cancer, or they have, you know, some disease that really costs a lot of money to treat.
Right.
And the only way to insure people like that is to provide a pool that includes healthy people.
Yes.
That's how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you segregate all the sick people and put them in this high-risk pool, first of all, it's really hilarious to consider that the Republican Party is going to fund those high-risk pools or subsidize them, because that's something they don't want to do either.
Well, you'll be given a $500 voucher and told to shop for yourself, sickie, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, your medicine costs $14,000 a month or whatever, and the Republican Party doesn't want to do anything about that either. So there really is a difference between the parties on this, and they've had 6 years to come up with an alternative because, you know, it's repeal and replace.
Right, and we've been hearing about this alternative for 5.5 years.
And what Paul Ryan isn't really getting is that the plan is to repeal and replace him.
Right.
So long-term, short-term, we'll see how that works out. But as you said, Driftglass, in your in our notes, Splinter is coming.
It is. It is. It is. It's coming, people.
We got to congratulate Donald Trump on his big win on Tuesday, because he won everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Like a cold nor'easter. Mm-hmm. He blew in and took everything.
Yep.
He took everything. And I am not surprised. Anyone who is surprised should be ashamed of themselves and turn in their pundit credentials immediately. But yeah, Donald Trump swept to victory in all the states where he was suspected. He won, I believe, every county in Pennsylvania.
Every single county. Rich, poor, doesn't matter. Yep.
And now it's down to Indiana, allegedly.
Allegedly. And then California, because that's now a game changer. There's been a big game changer this week.
Yeah. No, there is no game changer. Donald Trump is inexorably slouching towards Cleveland to be born.
Uh-huh.
And it's if he comes in 5 delegates short and can't give them each their
seal
own.
Seal the deal.
Yeah. With a bag of money, which he has a lot of, or a fleet of cars or hookers or whatever it is you want. He has private detectives. I know a lot of them are still in Hawaii looking for that birth certificate, but he could recall some small fraction of the private investigators who were looking into Obama's fake birth certificate and put them on the case of investigating, I don't know, uncommitted delegates who might have a peccadillo in their past or might enjoy a little bit on the side, a little lady or perhaps a gentleman on the side. Perhaps they enjoy the ponies. Perhaps they enjoy blow. perhaps they'd like Mark Halper, they'd like a ride in the helicopter.
In the helicopter or the plane, yeah. Come on up in the golden plane, sure.
And you're already, you know, 9/10 of the way there, and we just need a handful of you people to get with the program, get with the party. Unless you'd rather see your Republican Party destroyed.
I was going to say, I think if it really comes down to 5 or 6 delegates.
Yeah.
There's going to be 5 or 6 delegates who say, well, I really don't want a civil war here. You know, I really don't want – the television cameras are on right now. And we have to at least look like we have a plan.
There'll be 50 or 60, and there'll be a bidding war. You know, who can get to the trough first?
Yep.
Because the Trump train is leaving the station. Mm-hmm. And on board, currently on board, are such luminaries, such notable great Americans as John Bolton. And his mustache are on board. And Grover Norquist, slimy dung beetle. Grover Norquist is saying nice things about Donald Trump. Newt Leroy Gingrich, who was up until now the biggest grifter, con artist, con man, third married, amoral scumbag in the Republican Party, is finding many nice things to say about the speech that someone wrote for Donald Trump and that he said aloud in front of a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the usual suspects, all of the dregs of society who are commonly known as the most frequent guests on Sunday morning talk shows or respectable men of honor, are all coming out of the woodwork to join Donald Trump to get on board before all the seats are full.
Mm-hmm.
Because eventually, you know, I swear you can actually see Joe Scarborough slipping his resume to Donald Trump every morning.
I think that's true.
When he just gets on, Donald, you're so great. You know, I mean, and just berates anyone who says, well, maybe Donald Trump isn't the greatest thing since sliced bread. Maybe he's a... You found fault with him when he was improvising, and now he's reading from a teleprompter, and he's well prepared. And now, you know, it's like nothing he can do is going to make people happy. You're always criticizing. And it's like, wow, this is basically the same speech any alcoholic head of family will say about their abusive behavior. Nothing I do is good enough for you people. Except this asshole can fire you. Yeah. So everyone's sort of just, yes, Joe, whatever you say, Joe.
Well, and I've said this before, Drift Glass, and I said it on Twitter this morning, too. Uh-huh. Joe and Mika depend on Donald's contributions to their Manhattan charity balls.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a big fish in Manhattan, which is Rome.
Yes.
So, and he, you know, the discounts at Barney's and come on, be on my plane. And sure, I'll give $10,000 or $100,000 to your children's charity, mm-hmm. you know, ballroom, you know, shopping, whatever it is thing that you're doing, the opera for the kids or the. I mean, Mika's always doing something, you know, and good for her. She's always raising money. But it's an opportunity. This is what New York society is like. It's an opportunity to wear your fanciest clothes and go and applaud yourself and your friends for being good people.
Aren't we awesome?
So,
yes. Aren't we the best?
So and Donald is one of the people that, you know, you have him on speed dial.
Yeah.
The reason he's able to phone in all the time is they've already called him a dozen times this year for money, for checks, for whatever charity they're currently working on. So, you know, it's very important to them that he has to become presidential and reform his racism and tone that down. Because if he doesn't, then polite society in Manhattan a year from now can't accept him. And they have to accept him because he's the funder for their lifestyle.
And it doesn't, I really do think it doesn't really matter if he tones it down. They will say he tones it down.
Yep, exactly.
Every time he doesn't actually.
Or he didn't really mean it.
Yeah.
Or that's not the Donald I know. If you know him personally. How many times have we heard that?
Yeah.
If you know the one-on-one personal Donald, he's really a nice guy.
You know what? Here's the thing. I would love to hear a story about what goes on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But what I got a feeling that since Chuck Todd still exists and George Stephanopoulos still exists and Bill Kristol is still an honored and invited guest and an ABC employee and on and on, the whole long list of horrible people who cannot ever be fired from the media. And now that Joan Walsh is publicly saying, I break with Salon.
I would
love to hear a story about all the creepy, incestuous, bribing, threatening, browbeating bullshit that goes on just behind the curtain that makes it possible for all of this madness to happen. Because everyone who's worked at a large organization that has to present a public face, a basically dysfunctional organization, knows that the little public face you present is such a complete fiction.
Yep.
And when it's, you know, when you're an insurance company or a bank or a school or any of the places I've ever worked, that's fine. It's your marketing department. But the public face of the news media is the news.
Yeah.
And so when it's polluted, when it's corrupted, when it's incestuous, when it's all driven by bribes and threats and horrible backroom deals among corporate executives who are never interviewed, that's a real story. And that is the one story that absolutely no one anywhere even talks about, mentions, even it touches with a barge pole. Because if you start poking Phil Griffin in the eye and asking him, why do you have a right-wing liar on 3 hours in the morning? Mm-hmm. You will never work in television again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So everyone, this is just me inferring in the absence of evidence, because nobody will give us any evidence. No one will explain this phenomena. The only alternative is that everyone's job is on the line.
Well, I think everyone's job is on the line because they have to fill 24 hours a day. And they have, because they have to fill 24 hours a day, they want access to everybody. And that means you don't offend anybody. And because you can't offend anybody, that means that when someone outside the media who is in Congress or is a lobbyist or is a think tank person lies to your face, you have to sit there and smile and say, well, really, both sides.
Thanks for coming on. Which brings us to John Boehner.
Okay, I want to get to John Boehner in a minute, but before we do that, I just want to point out that there's a claim that, you know, I think there is a funding stream for conservative outlet that there's an understanding that if we tell the truth, we'll lose money.
Yes.
We will lose a lot of money. And that's true from an individual career standpoint,
yep.
that if Mark Halperin were to actually tell the truth about Donald Trump's speech yesterday, instead of saying, you know, a lot of this speech you could have heard in a Hillary Clinton speech.
You know, it's awfully close to it.
It's awfully close. And, you know, it's not 90% lies.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's as many lies as any political speech has, because he has to say that.
Sure.
He'll lose access to Donald Trump, which in this environment you cannot do.
Well,
he's got them all by the short hairs.
Except in I agree with you as a matter of general principle. In the case of Mark Halperin, I don't sense there is a good person in there struggling to get out.
No, I understand that. Right.
He's an amoral robot down to his shoe tops.
He has worked at it so long. Yeah. That he doesn't recognize that he's doing it anymore.
He's a creature of the system. He is born and bred for that.
But the claim, the thing that I find ironic is that there's a claim among certain comment threads this week that somehow on the left, there's this huge moneyed conspiracy to buy votes and buy bloggers and buy access to Twitter.
Uh-huh.
You know, I said, according to my comment stream, David Brock has taken over College Humor, Discus, LinkedIn, and the American Nurses Association.
Yeah.
You know, it's I understand the frustration level of certain people. I also want to point out to anyone who is upset by something that they see in a comment thread or Facebook or social media. Mm-hmm. In terms of, I'm going to give away some secrets here, Drift Glass.
No. Our Soros check will never come now.
There are no Soros checks.
Oh,
there are no Soros checks, except for Move On and a couple other places that are very high up.
Shut up. You're giving the conspiracy away.
There are no Soros checks. There just aren't.
There aren't.
And there are no David Brock checks. And if you see something in a common thread or social media, you know, I don't care what blog it is. And I'm not speaking for any blog I'm associated with at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The number of commenters compared to readers is usually about 150-1.
Yeah.
Literally 150 readers per on big blogs, 150 readers per one commenter. And comment threads really are a place on blogs, especially that have left their comment threads open.
Yeah.
Are a place for 20 or 25 people to talk to one another. That's definitely true over at Duncan Black's blog.
Sure.
He's got, 7,000 comments per... He'll put on Rock On, and all of a sudden there's 800 comments, right?
Yeah.
Because it's the same 25 people meeting at that place on the internet and talking to one another. And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's self-sustaining.
It is
not a content. It's not where you turn for the breaking news.
And he's made a joke about, why can't I monetize this comment thing?
Yeah. You do, Duncan. I look at your rails and your ads. You kind of do. But yeah, exactly. That's what it's there for.
And so if you ever see, nothing makes me laugh harder when I see a comment anywhere on the internet saying, we really have to flood the threads with this thing because get the word out. It's like, do you understand how many people actually read comments?
Yeah.
It's not many. And it's kind of important to keep it in that perspective. And then I'm not going to do Bible Bitch today, but I did want to point out that liberals are not serene people.
No, we're not.
No, they're just as just their nature. It is not in our nature.
Yeah.
Say, whatever, injustice,
Well, at some point,
what are you going to do?
At some point, we're not apathetic people.
No.
But at some point, you do reach a state of equilibrium between your rage and your acceptance of the system.
Well, this is what I said back in 2009, excuse me.
Uh-huh.
And I went and pulled it out. I was going through my archives. I saw this. I said, I got to tweet this because this really says a lot about today, too, which is pushing for justice requires the vigilance of a calm heart.
Yes.
And you finally realize that you have to save your vitriol and keep your eye on the prize.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that serenity prayer of accepting for today the things I can't change and get to work on changing the things I can and know the difference, that keeps you going for tomorrow.
Yeah, that's
what you got to do.
That's exactly what a conspirator would say. To throw us off the scent.
Well, David Brock told me to say
that. He told me. He's standing right behind me. Actually, for you sports fans out there, I think I, in a very similar way, I liken being a liberal in America today to being Walter Payton playing for the Bears.
Oh.
You are going to run 7 miles in your career, but you're going to get knocked on your ass every 2 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes your team is going to be so screwed up. Some years your team is going to be so bad that you are personally going to have to be the wide receiver and the tight end and the running back and the quarterback mm-hmm. and the place kicker. And you're going to even have to play defense. You're going to be exhausted and you're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a liberal in America is not a popular position.
No.
and there is no money to be made in telling rich people they should give their money to poor people.
No one's going to thank you for that either.
Telling oil companies that the shit we burn is ruining our children's futures is not a profitable position
right.
to take. Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to hear businesses need to be regulated or they're going to poison us.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do it because that's the price of citizenship. And right now, as the campaigns are entering sort of the summer stretch, is a really good time to practice a little kindness and generosity among ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Especially within the tent.
Yeah.
Especially within what is a big tent. The liberal people and Democratic Party and people who want social justice in this country
yes.
is a big tent of very wide-ranging people with lots of different agendas.
And there are lots of people who are new to the tent
yep.
who are extremely yep. passionate and do not understand why this shit is so screwed up and what the hell have you adults, in a manner of speaking, screwed up my country. What the hell's wrong with you people? And you know what? You're right. You're right. That this generation, my generation, the generation before it, the generation right after mine, have not fixed this country, have not fixed everything. And we have let you down
mm-hmm.
in substantial and important ways. But we're trying.
Mm-hmm.
And check back in 20 years. After you've pushed that rock that I'm going to give up pushing eventually when I retire or bus hits me or that Soros check comes in, then you got to carry that rock. Then you mm-hmm. have to haul that shit up the hill. And that'll be your job. And it'll be your kids' job. And then eventually you will look back and see, oh, we've come quite a long way. Over the course of decades or generations, we've come an awfully long way. But the day-to-day is awful.
Mm-hmm.
And we fight each other and we get angry with each other and we accuse each other of terrible crimes because our guy is losing or our woman is losing or our cause is losing. And it's a terrible, terrible, terribly bitter pill to swallow. It is. And it always has been and always will be. So now is a really good time to extend a little kindness
mm-hmm.
and generosity if your candidate is winning. And let people have the space to be angry that they've invested themselves in something big and beautiful and it didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
Let them be pissed off. Let them hate you. Let them rage. Don't, you know, be generous in victory and be gracious in defeat.
Yeah, if that's where you are. And if you are a Bernie supporter.
Keep going.
Keep going.
Keep going. All the way to California, all the way to the convention. Don't stop. Don't stop. Don't stop in 2016. Don't stop in 2018 where there's a midterm election. Don't mm-hmm. stop in 2020. Do not stop. But don't mistake people who differ from you slightly with your mortal enemies.
Yeah. And also, I wanted to add, I think I've said this before, you know, to our kids, to the 13-year-old and the 17-year-old, mm-hmm. the fight for gay marriage took 6 months.
Right. It was over a long weekend, right?
Paying attention.
Yeah.
When they started paying attention, you know,
yeah.
and went to their first Pride event,
yeah.
when you filled up the van with kids,
I did.
To go to the, I couldn't go because there was nowhere to sit. The kids, they brought all their friends. Everybody wanted to go. They all wanted to wear their rainbow hats. They all yeah. wanted to go and do this thing and make this happen. And, you know, the victory in the Supreme Court happened 6 months later.
Right.
They don't remember that it took
decades.
Centuries.
Well, centuries in a very real sense. Centuries, yeah. Because, and that's fine. It should become normal.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
should be. But it should become normal in the habits of our daily lives. It should never become normal in, let's forget that this was a long-ass struggle and it's not over and it can be rolled back tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, That's true of all of
our
advances.
They're trying to roll a lot of it back, and that's, you know, that's what the bathroom thing is all about. It's real resistance in people's mentality to accepting what is just there, you know. And people, transgender people, have been there all along, and you just all of a sudden, because you're being asked to accept that fact, it's a problem.
Right, and their world is shrinking, and your world is growing.
Yeah.
And they don't like it one little bit. And there's a lot of money for people who are angry and paranoid and hateful, who are willing to put their anger and hatred and paranoia in the service of a really despicable political cause.
Speaking of angry people, John Boehner.
Yeah. Well, I just want to point out, this is the week that Ted Cruz hired the Wicked Witch of the West.
Well, I want to be very careful about that. I've said to my cohorts at Crooks and Liars, like, be careful you don't say anything about Carly Fiorina that you wouldn't say about a Democratic woman, because, you know, the problem with Carly Fiorina is she is a compulsive liar,
right,
who loves people named Carly Fiorina.
Yes. Well, I mean, she has the voice and the mentality and the wickedness,
yeah,
of a monster. And she is perfectly willing to make up lies about liberals selling baby parts,
yep,
to advance,
yep,
her political
That's
career.
That's pure evil.
She's
That's
an evil
pure
person.
Pure evil.
She's a, yeah, fucking evil person. She cashiered 30,000 people from HP, and then walked out the door with a golden parachute. Now she goes on television and talks about how the elites in this country have let us all down. Well, okay, that's fine. You get to do that, and I get to laugh at you for it,
yeah,
and call you a despicable scumbag.
Yeah, right.
And of course, the problem with the Cruz, you know, the Cruz candidacy, and I do want to talk about Boehner. The problem with Cruz is he's already an awful person.
Yeah,
I made this analogy earlier when we were talking. He's Agnew.
He's not Spiro Nixon. Agnew.
He's fucking Spiro. He's the guy you hired to be an asshole.
Yeah.
To,
yep,
be an attack dog, but he,
yep,
that's him by nature. So who's he going to turn to? Well, he's, yep, going to turn to someone even more loathsome and awful,
mm-hmm,
and vicious and amoral than he is to,
yep,
be his attack dog. Even though, by any accounting, his campaign is over.
Yeah.
There's no possibility Ted Cruz is ever going to go anywhere except back to Texas, where he probably will not keep his job. Because, as we now learn today, and this is the segue to Boehner, oh my God, apparently, having retired to his summer place, which is the bottom of a bottle of Bombay gin.
I was going
to
say the bottom of a rusty nail.
Yeah. John Boehner is suddenly...
What is Drambuie anyway?
It's a liqueur, and it's sweet.
Oh, it's sweet. Okay.
And it fucks with your sense of time and space. It's like a poor man's absinthe. I don't know. It's a liqueur. I don't drink... If it's not... On the Lagavulin scale,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, it doesn't matter to me. I'm not going to put it in what I drink. But John Boehner, freed from the need to be the leader of his party anymore.
Yeah. And by the way, he's now giving speeches for money. I think, you know, that's really interesting.
Shocking. But the only way you're allowed to tell the truth about the Republican Party, and I want to get to the part about that really.
Well, what he
really
said about Cruz, yeah.
Was, I mean, he let Ted Cruz have it and the rest of his party, frankly, with, yeah, both barrels.
Yeah, he did.
He really just lit into him. You know, Ted Cruz is Lucifer in the flesh.
Lucifer in the flesh. Yep.
Miserable son of a bitch. And you know what? That's a pretty good campaign ad.
And one of my friends told me today that that line about I've never worked with a more miserable son of a bitch in my life, that, uh-huh, that is old school legislator talk.
Yeah.
That you really have worse things to say about that person,
yeah,
but you say, he's a miserable son of a bitch. You know, mm-hmm, what are you going to do? But that is a way of saying, I can't tell you really how awful this person is and how, yeah, much I despise him.
Yeah, but take my word for it.
Take my word for it. But he's, yeah, a miserable son of a bitch is a way of sort of, bless his heart, right? You actually are sugarcoating it when you say that. So, mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah,
He let it
out there that this was what Ted Cruz really is to him, mm-hmm, and Ted Cruz said that you know, John Boehner was not only insulting him but insulting the American people.
America, it's healthy America, and you know
the American people when you talk like that, John.
And as I predicted, you know, it's not really hard to predict. It's not exactly a prediction to watch an apple fall. And say, yeah, it's going to hit the ground. Oh, and it hit. See, look what a freaking genius I am. Of course, John Boehner is now Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
According to Ted Cruz and Sean Hannity,
yeah,
and
yeah,
et cetera, et,
yeah,
cetera.
Yeah.
You know, there's no difference between Sean Hannity, between John Boehner and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi. They're all, you know, the Washington cartel. Well, what do you expect John to say? I didn't share three words with him, and now he's calling me this. You know, he's really insulting the American people, you good, mm-hmm, people out there. And of course he is, because I read the entire Vox article. First of all, I read my wife's article.
Oh, thank you.
Came out well in advance of the Vox article. Because she's on it, man. On it. And I read the Vox article, which is fine. The Vox article is entitled, just so you know, John Boehner just confirmed everything liberals suspected about the Republican Party.
Yeah.
There's something really insulting about that.
Yep.
And so my post is entitled, Ezra Klein just confirmed everything liberals suspected about the mainstream media.
Yeah.
Which is, why do we need John Boehner to confirm what we already know to be true?
Yep.
Why is it not a story? Why is a mountain of facts, miles of videotape, all the history and proof in the world you could possibly need for every fucking issue? I'm not just talking about this one thing, but everything. Everything. Why is it always insufficient if it's coming from a liberal? But when a conservative comes along, now we can take it seriously. Now we can talk about it on Meet the Press. Now we can pull up a chair and let's have a broader discussion about this. But mm-hmm. when it's liberals saying that George Bush is a disaster, when it's liberals saying that he's going to create deficits or lie us into the wrong war or torture people, or that Barack Obama really isn't a Kenyan usurper, or that there are no death panels, that's insufficient, even though the facts and the math are blindingly obvious. Mm-hmm. It requires some rummy to come stumbling in from his vacation home, say, yeah, you know what? Cruz really is a fucking son of a bitch. I hated that man my entire life. Oh, now it's a story. Now it's a story because a conservative said it.
Yep.
But here's the trick. John Boehner will not be a conservative for very long.
No, he's now a rhino.
He's a rhino. He's a rhino. You can't listen to this man. What do you expect? What do you expect from a member of the Washington cartel? Because every conservative who finally wanders off the talking point, the straight and narrow, John Boehner cannot walk a double yellow. He can't touch his nose to his hand. He stumbled off the party line. And what happens to every single, Bruce Bartlett being a good example of this, who I like and respect, Kathleen Parker for about 2 hot minutes when she said Sarah Palin is an awful person, suddenly discover there's a whole big boiling vat of wingnut oil waiting for anyone who dares to step out of the Rush Limbaugh, hate radio, Fox News accepted level of discourse.
Yeah.
And you will be burned to the ground if you step out of the line. And that's what's happening to Boehner right now. Boehner is going to be dismissed. He'll be mocked. He'll be insulted. He'll be shunted aside. The mainstream media will pick him up like a chew toy for a few days and toss him aside. And that's it. Because it is.
I do want to mention, though, that in his quote, he called it the Democrat Party.
Of course he did. He can't help
himself. I know people who are in the Democrat Party and in the Republican Party, and everybody I know caught that. Like, you're still using the insult.
Well,
you know,
that gives him street cred. It lets everyone know that I'm really a conservative. He also, I'm reading again from, the money shot for me was in the 16th paragraph of the Vox article, which is where the fifth paragraph was, I love these knuckleheads talking about the party of Reagan.
Yeah.
He would be the most moderate Republican elected today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. But way down in the 16th paragraph, Ezra Klein says, in other words, for a critique like this to really have bite, it would need to come from a true dyed-in-the-wool Republican.
Yep.
Someone whose loyalty to the party couldn't be questioned, someone who clearly wanted Republicans to succeed and prosper. Because it literally doesn't matter how right you are if you are a liberal. You're never, ever going to be allowed at the big boy table. The only people who are allowed are people who conform to the Beltway party line. That's it. That's the rule. But there's the trick. There's the problem.
As you said, in the 17th paragraph of this column, Ornstein and Mann come up.
Yeah, exactly.
And all of a sudden it's about, it really isn't both sides.
Yeah. Well, to give Ezra Klein credit, it's about he brings up Mann and Ornstein, who wrote this thing in 2012 and were exiled.
Yep.
Who were cast out. You can't say that shit. And the Republican response is, they're basically liberals. What do you expect from liberals like that? You know how those people are. No criticism. There is no ability for the Republican Party to reform itself because it is internally incapable of acknowledging what's going on inside the party. This is what...
Well, and they have a serious problem with their base in that their base has been convinced that governing is a bad thing.
Yeah.
The act of government is evil. So, and that's what Ted Cruz represents. Who's going to fight against Washington if it's not for me and my people?
Exactly.
So, that's the code for being in the Tea Party now. That's what you're supposed to do, is mess up the works and block things.
Anything, everything.
I do want to give Ezra Klein credit for taking it that next step and recognizing that no, really, this doesn't just talk about Boehner being drunk and saying something that was true.
Right.
It has to do with the Republican Party is really broken.
Right.
Because the base of the Republican Party that they all have to serve is nuts.
Is nuts. And yeah. And yet, in the Washington Post, Michael Gerson, persistent beltway stalactite, Michael Gerson, George Bush speechwriter and tool of power, Michael Gerson, the emergency break glass in case David Brooks is in Cuba, Michael Gerson, which he is, has been writing column after column after column about the horrors of Donald Trump,
yeah.
Not the Republican Party, of Donald Trump. It's only Trump. It's just Trump. Everything else is fine.
So every voter, every county in Pennsylvania is fine.
It's fine.
The problem is Trump. But every county in Pennsylvania voted for Trump, and he won't acknowledge that that's a problem.
And so his headline is, buying into Trump's fake pivot would ruin the GOP. And my response is, would ruin?
Would?
What do you mean, would? No, it was ruined. It's been ruined for years. It was ruined before you took the king's coin to make W sound good. It's been ruined for decades, Michael. And the reason you don't know that or don't acknowledge that is because you're a liar for a living. You live inside of a little bubble, and this is what terrified the crap out of me. As a brief aside, I found this Spiro Agnew video. I now find that I agree with Spiro Agnew, which is, it took 50 years.
I think actually it's the opposite. I think the mainstream media has flipped so dramatically since Spiro Agnew was vice president.
I was being funny,
that
but you're right.
You can now agree with the words that came out of Spiro Agnew's mouth. There is a media conspiracy to hide the truth.
Yeah. A parochial group of people in New York and Washington, D.C., who talk only to each other, who read only each other's works, and who never get out of the bubble and see what the real country is like, what's really going on out here.
Yep.
And whose high opinions of themselves would be not problematic were it not for the fact that they control the fucking media.
Yeah.
They control the New York Times.
That there's a difference between talking about Vietnam and talking about the Bush administration.
Right. The Vietnam War was a disaster.
It was a disaster, and they were losing, and we were losing for a long time, and we allowed Nixon and Spiro Agnew to tell us that you're being unpatriotic if you don't support the war, even though the war was corrupt.
And
now
wrong.
We have a media that says
that
cheerleads war, cheerleads for ratings, cheerleads Trump, puts the Trump podium on the air for half an hour. This came up with a colleague yesterday that, you know, we're waiting for this speech, this big foreign policy speech, right?
Ooh, yes.
It's like, yeah. And someone texted me and said, this was supposed to start half an hour ago. I said, well, haven't you gotten it by now that that's part of the plan?
Right.
Is to keep them all waiting and having the word Trump on the screen for half an hour before he shows up, so that he can show everyone, I have these guys by the short hairs. I own them. And they will sit here, and no matter what else is going on with San Bernardino or with Flint or with the economy or with the war, they will sit here and wait for me. That makes me important.
I'm the story. Everything else is number two.
Yep.
I'm number one.
Yep.
And so Michael Gerson, who, again, was Bush speechwriter, Beltway insider, job for life at the Washington Post, you know, enjoys all of the perks and prerequisites and privileges of power, white male Republican insider Beltway power, concludes that Reince Priebus should just resign in protest.
He's quitting in January anyway.
Yeah, I know. So big deal. Big fucking deal. But, yeah, if
in other words, he should walk out in protest because a real Republican is not being nominated at the convention.
Exactly. Well,
is that the idea?
He should leave in a huff, or as Groucho says, or a minute and a huff. But the thing is, here's the thing. What he's protesting, what Michael Gerson is protesting, but he dares not say, and no one will ever point this out to him because they're all his friends and they're all his co-conspirators, is what you're protesting, Michael, is the Republican nominee who won more votes than anyone going to the Republican convention to collect his nomination.
Mm-hmm.
That's democracy. You might not like it, but that's what democracy looks like. But to Michael Gerson, and I'm quoting him directly now, if Priebus ends up blessing the Trump nomination, the results would reach far beyond 2016, as if his blessing is required.
Yeah.
It would turn the sins of Trump into the sins of the GOP.
They are the sins of the GOP. They are the sins.
And that's what Michael Gerson, who's a filthy liar, can't admit. Cannot admit. That's what none of them could admit. Donald Trump is not some weird, freakish exception. He is the Republican
party. And no, none of the Republican voters in Pennsylvania or California or Connecticut or anywhere give a shit what Reince Priebus thinks.
Or Michael Gerson.
Or what Michael Gerson.
Or any of these people.
No, they don't.
Michael Gerson insists that Reince Priebus should resign rather than be complicit, as his party is defiled. He uses the word defiled. Michael, your party was defiled 30 years ago when you crawled on top of it and started feeding off of it. Mm-hmm. You're a parasite, man. You're a scumbag. Now, that's you're making a living, and you're going to go on making a living because the beast you're feeding off of is so big, it's going to take decades for it to properly die off. But I can see what you're doing. All the liberals out here can see what you're doing. We know you're a liar. This is why we're not allowed anywhere near cameras, because about 2 minutes into a conversation with Michael Gerson, any liberal would start asking these same questions. Like, where the fuck were you 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Where the hell was this concern when the guy you worked for lied us into the wrong war? And that's when we go to commercial, because we can't talk about things like that.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And this happened yesterday on Twitter with Mark Halperin.
Yeah.
That a couple people told him, you know, you deciding to give Donald Trump credibility.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to examine. I'd like to talk about where we were 10 years ago.
Hmm.
Because 10 years ago, we were coming up to a midterm election in 2006.
And
Democrats were poised to take the Congress, take the House.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was a moment there where the critique of the Republican Party, what was actually happening inside the Republican Party, the collapse of the Republican Party, was so congruent with what liberals had been saying all along that it became impossible to pretend that there weren't a bunch of people out there who've been right about the Bush administration.
Well, I can let's talk about that now, because I can tell you what happened. What happened at that point was they started to have liberals on, and liberals started to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And so they had Marcos on the TV.
Yeah, once.
And, yeah.
Shut that shit down.
Marcos told the truth. And Marcos said, you know, these Republicans are a bunch of draft evaders.
Right.
And I went to Iraq. You know, Marcos is a vet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to war. Where were you?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to hear that. They'll walk off the air. And if you can't get Republican legislators on your show, if the Beltway, your Beltway Rolodex shrinks by even one card, you're gone. So it
Beltway pundits have a great union. You know that?
Yeah.
They really do. They will go on strike to prevent any of their own from getting in trouble for saying anything awful.
Right. And you hear that all the time, where I'm not going to say anything to destroy anybody's career, you know. And do you want to talk about your stridency?
Me?
A minute.
Sure. Sure. Well, 10 years ago, the Beltway, I mean, Steve Gilliard was still with us. And I was 2 years into blogging, or a year and a half into blogging. But the internet had the promise of making access to the media semi-permeable in both directions.
Yeah.
You know, we were going to be a voice at the table. There was no illusion we were going to take over.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a sort of general thought that you can't just, we're so right, and it's so clear, and there are bodies coming home to this country in coffins because of the lies we were told. And the deficits that this administration ran up are bigger than any in history. You can't cover this shit up anymore.
Right.
So that there's going to be some reckoning, and we're going to have some. We're going to have a day where we will talk back to the media, and they will have to listen. And the internet blogging will facilitate that somehow.
Well, and in 2006, we did win the Congress back. Right. The Democratic Party did get the House back.
Yes, indeed. But the media portion of that equation failed.
Mm-hmm.
We were very quickly shut down and shut out. All the newspapers, they looked in horror at what we were proposing, which was talking about actual things that really were happening, and they shut us down. And ever since then, the liberal presence on the air has been constricting and constricting and constricting to the point where it's almost non-existent. There are a couple of liberals still on television in the evening on MSNBC, but pretty much that's it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's weird, because the constriction, that the deliberate dismemberment of liberal voices on television, on the radio, in print, has gone right along with the complete psychotic breakdown of the Republican Party in public, in front of everyone to see. So there is something in between those two. There are a group of people in between those two who don't give a shit that the country is falling apart or are profiting hugely off of it. MSNBC executives, NBC executives, ABC executives, CNN executives are all betting, are all profiting from this somehow, or they would do things differently. There's no third alternative that I can think of. And so this is where we are. We're at a place, once again, 10 years later, where strident people like me, you really want me to talk about that? Okay.
Yeah.
Just for a hot minute. So there are people who act in my interest from time to time.
Yes.
Or what they think is my interest. And they don't know anything about me. I'm sure their intentions are very good. And they are they explore possible job opportunities for me out there in the world. I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know if they're making it up. I assume it's true. I assume it's correct. So word gets back to me that people are actually aware of who I am and what I say and what I do and how I write. But I'm a little too strident. That's the problem. I'm not employable by anyone anywhere doing anything like what I do on my blog or my podcast anywhere because I'm a little too strident. I'm a little too shrill.
And I like the comparison you made.
To Ann Coulter?
Yeah.
Yeah. So really, because Ann Coulter can get her book published tomorrow, and her books are entitled Traitor and Liar and How Liberals Should Die in the Streets Like Dogs.
Yeah. And she can say we should convert all Muslims to Christianity or have them killed.
Or have them
killed.
I mean, killed.
You know, she can say things like that.
And then she's invited on MSNBC to talk about her views.
But I think there's a difference between you and Ann Coulter and the rest of the, but you go ahead.
Ramesh Panuru, who is an honored and dignified reform icon. his book, I believe, was called The Party of Death.
Yeah.
There are any number of conservative, respectable people. Hugh Hewitt by day, monster albino robot who lies about everything. By night, he's Chuck Todd's best friend. Yeah. You can't get him off the air. Bill Kristol, who really should be in prison or living under a bridge somewhere, cannot be fired from television, no matter what monstrous, evil, horrible, fraudulent, shrill, strident thing he says. Mm-hmm. And it's not that he's just employed by Town Hall. He's employed by ABC News.
Yeah.
And Newt Gingrich, who has got a long and colorful record of being a horrible person and saying deeply racist, horrible crap, is an honored guest on every show. So stridency clearly isn't the issue.
Yeah, yeah. But there is an issue. I think there's an issue.
Yes.
From the standpoint of, and I've told you this.
Yes, you have. Tell me again.
You name names.
I do.
You attack the people, as I said, who are in the Beltway Rolodex.
Yes.
And so, and you attack people in the tent with the Beltway Rolodexes,
mm-hmm.
and who are there to discuss the people or interview the people who are in the Beltway Rolodexes. Club circles the wagons every
may
time.
I offer one correction?
Yeah.
And it's just a very minor thing, but it's important to me. I don't ever feel I attack them. I ask in a very loud and angry voice, why are you saying something that is so patently untrue?
Mm-hmm.
Please answer my query. Please, I wrote a tweet to Margaret Sullivan,
mm-hmm.
who's the public editor of the New York Times, asking her, who's paying for David Brooks' trip to Cuba?
Yeah.
I'll never hear back from her. I one-way correspond with lots of people at MSNBC. I never hear back from them because they're not interested in what I have to say or do. But really, for all of my stridency and the nasty words I sometimes use on my blog and sometimes here, I really don't hate any of these people because I've never met any of these people.
Mm-hmm.
What I really despise is the fact that they lie.
But you mention them by name and tell them that they are lying.
Yes.
And I noticed something this week that really surprised me, and this is not a criticism of her at all.
Mm-hmm.
Amy Goodman, who I think does the Lord's work.
She does.
On the media, mm-hmm. you know, in Democracy Now! And so forth. But she has a YouTube up talking about Donald Trump and talking about how, you know, the media lets him phone in interviews,
mm-hmm.
and films his podium for half an hour and basically has given him six times the coverage of any other candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about why. But she goes on to say, to use the Noam Chomsky idea of manufacturing consent, that they have manufactured consent for the Beltway and mainstream media has manufactured consent for Donald Trump to be a legitimate candidate for president.
Yes.
Throughout this video, she does not mention Joe Scarborough once.
No.
She does not mention MSNBC once. She does not mention anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I I don't think that she is doing that in order to strengthen her argument. But I do think she's consciously doing it. I think she's consciously addressing the problem without addressing the personalities involved. And that's a conscious choice. Mm-hmm. Because it allows her then mm-hmm. to go on ABC News this week every once in a while.
Yes.
And you know, Katharina VandenHeuvel does the same thing. You know, she's allowed to go on TV every once in a while. It's a choice. But somebody has to say the problem is Joe Scarborough.
Or the problem is problem is the person who hires Joe Scarborough and lets him get away with murder.
Yeah.
And that guy's name is Phil Griffin.
Yeah. So
Let me add one more, Philip, to that, because I don't disagree with anything you just said. I would also add, I'm unable to pay a publicist $5,000 a week, whatever it is.
To be in that Rolodex, one of the coins that he can trade to get someone else on. I mean, that's usually how it works, is you pay a publicist a lot of money, and then, you want to have Lindsey Graham on, or whoever my client is that you want to have. Well, you've mm-hmm. got to also have this person that has a new book out.
Right.
Has to be on your radio program, or has mm-hmm. to be somewhere where he can pimp his book.
It's a package deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't have a patron, or we don't have patrons who are willing
Except
to pay.
Except David Brock.
Well, of course. But, you know, he pays us in those John McCain points.
Yeah.
And they're not really tradable on the open market.
I'd forgotten all about McCain points. Oh.
McCain points, yeah. I'd forget nothing. But since most people on the left have no patron and don't have five or whatever the grand that is a week to pay a publicist or a month a publicist to bribe their way on the air, which is how it works,
mm-hmm.
Or a friend of the media. Or they, you know, there are people who are regular guests on MSNBC who are clearly friends of people who are hosts on MSNBC.
Yeah.
And they have no business being on television otherwise. But Ben Dominic somehow manages to find his way on camera on lots of different places, even though he has a rich and storied history of being shrill and strident and doing really sketchy, dodgy, often illegal things or working for really scummy people. So clearly there's a method, there's a pathway there. It usually involves money or contacts, neither of which most liberals have. So that's how it works. That's how the media works. And that's why we're doing this from a cornfield. And we wouldn't have it any other way.
Yep, yep, yep. All right, we have to go now.
We do. We have people coming home soon. It's been kind of a crazy busy week.
Yes, it has. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Emmy.
Emmy!
Emmy looks calm and serene in this photo, but she has a serious temper if you do something unforgivable, like take her to the vet.
Yeah, no.
She has also mastered not work safe meowing at the vet also.
Oh, I'm familiar with that sound. Yeah.
You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, or you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Driftglass, did you notice at Hillary Clinton's town hall with Rachel Maddow this week that she put two fists in the air when she had a question from a member of the Postal Union?
I did not.
She did. She had a question from the audience about mm-hmm. keeping jobs in the United States, and he identified himself as a member of the United States Postal Union, and she put her two fists in the air. I was so proud. Just so you know, I mean, they can mm-hmm. do something good, and she did. She went, yeah. So that was good to see.
That's why she bribes us to say what we do.
See, that's she got David Brock to send me a check to say that. No, she didn't. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local. We also believe in shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box store.
Mm-hmm.
Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. And thank you to the people who have written and said that they are now listening on Google Play.
Yep.
We appreciate hearing back from you. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties remind us all that they use a transgender bathroom every damn day and don't have time for your nonsense.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Just think about loving.
Think about loving.
Just think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, loving, loving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, we are reading your stories based on the images that we posted to our Facebook page and our Twitter stream. Our Twitter stream is at Pro Left Podcast, and we're also on Facebook. And so the first one comes from Andrew.
Hello, Andrew.
And
if that is your real name,
we don't care.
We don't care.
Andrew wrote a story called Odd Day.
Uh-huh.
He had no idea why he awakened next to an unknown woman. Orange morning sunlight poked through window blinds and birds trilled a dozen unfamiliar songs. The cell phone on the nightstand began playing 1812 Overture. He knew the melody, but not the phone's unlock code. He couldn't shut off the alarm. He buried the device under his pillow. The woman was now awake. He shuddered. Who was she? Why was she here? Morning, sweetheart. She stretched, smiled, reached for his arm. Hello. He forced a grin, his mind racing back and forth, trying to assemble memories of the day before. Do you want breakfast? She sat up, swung long legs over the bedside. She was wearing an oversized Duke University t-shirt, nothing else. Her fingers played with his forearm for a moment. I'll go get started. Bacon, eggs, toast with plum jam, the usual. The usual what? His mind fumbled. This woman, the room, the pulsing alarm were all familiar to someone, but not him. Just then, the faintest bit of memory poked a tiny hole in the blank wall of his brain. It was May 3rd. An odd day. He knew then he had to find the other phone, the one whose code he knew, unlock it, and read his odd day journal. Then he would know her name, who she was. His wife, a friend, someone he only met last night? Damn! He must have fallen asleep again without making certain the odd day phone was close to him. It could be anywhere in the house. It was his house, wasn't it? He couldn't be sure. Until he located the other phone.
Ooh.
All right.
Yeah. A little bit of recall.
A little bit of recall.
Now I can smell that bacon cooking. And up until that moment, it could have been any morning for a lot of guys over many years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who's this woman in bed with me? What is she doing here? Why didn't I write her name down on my hand so I could remember it the next day?
Well, I can tell you from a woman's perspective,
playing the woman card, really? You're doing that?
Already?
Right now? Yeah. Okay, fine.
Sure. I think there's a lot of clues that this isn't a one-night stand.
Yeah.
She calls him sweetheart, which is not what you would call somebody who's a one-night stand. And she says the usual. That's a dead giveaway that he knows what he's having breakfast. So.
There's the point at which it bends, yeah.
Yeah, so that's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. It's very clear. It almost is defiantly starting at the beginning of the day, the beginning of the morning, in defiance of the rule that we said to never start a story there.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter if you make it work. So, way to go.
You made it work, yes.
You did. It's a fine story, and I would suggest you go with it. I would offer some unsolicited advice. Take it for what it's worth if you want to continue writing this. There is a story, a novel, actually, called Day World by Philip Jose Farmer. And I think it's based on a short story, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up.
Okay.
But it's a world in which people are allocated days of the week.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
There are people called daybreakers,
mm-hmm,
who transgress the rules and break into days that are not, they're not supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have basically several different, entirely different worlds running side by side, day by day. Mm-hmm. And some people sneak from one to the next. I think, but I'm not sure, it's based on a short story where the condition is schizophrenia.
Oh, okay.
Where people have multiple personalities, and that's mm-hmm. kind of a normal thing in this world, but I'm
oh,
not
wow.
sure.
Yeah.
Don't hold me to that. But it's similar. And there's also Scanner Darkly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By Philip K. Dick, which is about someone who is, thanks to the drugs he's taking, his personality splits into two halves, and half of it is a drug agent. The other half is the drug dealer that the drug agent is chasing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a rich genre, but there is a story in this genre of lost memory. What am I doing here? Waking up in a strange world. That is literally called Day World. That is very similar to this in mm-hmm. plot.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean you can't write it.
Right.
Any more than it means, you know, oh, I'm sorry, Mary Shelley did, you can never write about raising the dead.
Yeah.
Or creating artificial life or something like that because.
Right. Or anyone that eats blood. You can never do that.
No, sorry. No, Bram Stoker did that. So shut up. No, there are big, you can't write about time travel because that's been done too. There are big, rich genres and sort of memory loss and what's going on. Even Memento.
Yeah.
The movie Memento is a wonderful example of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it would behoove you, if you're going to write about it, to know that specific novel well enough to be able to talk about how you're not just borrowing from it.
Right.
Or if you intend to, that's fine too. You can parody things. You can write homages to things. That's all legit. It's just knowing the terrain under which you're stepping
mm-hmm.
to avoid any unnecessary complications.
And you've told the story before of the guy who basically wrote Superman for
in a science fiction class. In a college science fiction class.
I was attending. Called it Ultraman.
Yeah, Superioris. And he literally didn't understand the concept of plagiarism.
Yeah.
He just thought you just take a story and copy it and change a few words and then it's your story. and the teacher, who was not a gentle soul, really felt sorry for the guy and just said, okay, let's stop here and talk about a concept called plagiarism.
And
made it a teachable moment. Did not focus on this poor kid who had no idea that what he was doing was wrong and shouldn't have been in this class, probably shouldn't have been in college. But I made it a moment where we can, you know, the difference between borrowing from a literary genre, doing a call out to things. You've suggested, for example, that the stories I used to invent for our two girls might be a wonderful children's story someday.
Mm-hmm.
But that I should footnote it with all the references to this I stole from Heinlein, this I stole from Asimov, this I stole from Philip Dick. Just as an amusement for adults in there as well. That's okay too. Just know the people who've gone before you, so you won't be surprised.
Yeah.
When I forget what it was called, it was so bad. Time Code, I think. A few years ago, when mm-hmm. I actually had an active conversation going with Harlan Ellison, which was kind of exciting. Somebody did a movie in which the master timekeeper would take away your time if you transgressed the law. And everyone, I think we saw it in a preview at a theater we were attending, probably a much more highbrow thing. It was a shock to me that they would show a crappy trailer like that. And it's like, oh, that's Repent, Harlequin Set the TikTok Man. That's a Harlan Ellison story. That is way, way clearly a Harlan Ellison story in which a master timekeeper revokes your time if you transgress the law.
Right, I remember that.
And
it
turned out to be, well, it was such a sucky movie that it wasn't worth suing over. So why bother? But it does pay to know the genre you're stepping into. And good job, Andrew. Nicely done.
All right. I'm going to switch over, flip these papers.
This paper.
So we printed these on paper.
So we can write our notes, our bitchy little notes.
Our bitchy little notes.
We don't really do that. But this one is from Sam.
Samuel.
It has no title. But it begins as follows. This is a story from Sam, and it begins as follows. A faraway rhythmic clanging rang through the caverns. Wilson was as cold and weary as the others when they rounded a bend in the seemingly endless silence and darkness of the tunnel and caught the first tinging in their ears and the first glimpse of light from the camp. She halted briefly with them as they took it in before a shove from a rifle and an angry grunt got her moving again. "Is that it?" someone behind her asked excitedly. "I'm dying for a rest." Wilson rolled her eyes. They were all dying, quite literally. From the remote battlefield of the Dwan Trick Caverns, where they had been captured, they had been taken by transport train through a wilderness of dark tunnels, far from civilization's frontier, past little villages and forlorn natives. Now they had been marched for another 20 days or so, even further into the darkness. Most of them had nothing left of their boots, and their uniforms were so tattered they were unrecognizable. 5 soldiers had been buried along the way. Only the stern but friendly admonishments of old Colonel Nicholson kept the band of unfortunates moving forward. They held only contempt for the sneering faces and ancient rifles of their captors, men and weapons who couldn't make it in the fighting, Wilson supposed. It was clear that the Empire intended to put them to work, but no one could guess what kind of work they would be given all the way out here. Just before they entered the ramshackle compound of caves, filled with improvised wooden shacks, they were guided along a rushing brook, and Wilson scooped up a handful of water, brought it to her lips, and then spit. Salt water. Another shove. Colonel Nicholson shouted for her soldiers to form up into a military file, quote, "to show these Empire chaps what proper military discipline looks like," unquote. And with their last measure of strength, the pathetic little band stood as straight as they could and marched as much in time as they could into the compound, whistling their company march song through parched lips. Colonel Nicholson brought out the best in her soldiers. She was by-the-book strict in the old-fashioned style of her generation of aristocratic officers who firmly believed they were born to their positions. But she applied her discipline as part of her faith that it was essential for keeping up morale. And she was right. Winston, I believe you mean Wilson, thought of her as a competent leader, and the younger conscript saw her as a mother figure. Her speech was full of little references to the home life they all missed. This way, they never forgot that they were fighting to keep the lights on in Jamesville, or the mushroom crop free from the Empire's control in Shoulderstone, or to keep New Portland from being exposed to the sky, as the Empire had threatened to do to all of the Coastal Alliance's shallower cities. And so her soldiers all obeyed intently as she lined them up on the enemy's parade ground. But Wilson began to wonder if Nicholson hadn't begun to cross a line between encouraging her soldiers and aiding the enemy. The end.
All right, recall.
Recall.
Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah, yeah.
My recall.
Yeah, the Bataan Death March.
Yeah.
And Bridge on the River Kwai.
But.
Yeah.
Underground civilization.
Yeah.
And women.
Female officers, absolutely. Yep.
And I did like the idea of the exposing a city to the sky is somehow the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
And I think when you and I read this earlier out loud to each other, uh-huh. You said he put that right in the right place.
Yes.
That he talked about keeping the lights on, growing the mushrooms, and then exposed to the sky. It's like, oh, so no. Some things are normal and some things are really, really, really not normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was very nice.
Female officers, which is a nice, you know, nice touch. It's telling you that it's clearly an alien world or it's an alternate history. It sounds like you're way, way, way far from the coast. So I'm not sure what salt water is doing there. Although maybe this isn't Earth.
Well, and he does talk about the Coastal Alliance's shallower cities.
Uh-huh.
You don't know if there's flooding underground in some way. And, yeah, you don't know how high the oceans have gotten. I mean, he didn't get into what the environment is like. That's what I'd like to see more of in this story.
Is this a post-climate change apocalypse story?
where everyone's moved underground because the ozone's all gone, or
everything's flooded.
Yeah.
And salt water is everywhere.
Yeah. I do like the idea that the worst thing that can happen to a group of people is that somehow their tunnel gets collapsed in some way so that they are exposed to the sky. Yeah. That's really cool.
I like the idea that just for recall purposes, you're rolling past little villages and forlorn natives. That's a nice sense.
Really nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's easy to remember what's going on in this story. And like we talked about in the previous story, if this is an homage to Bridge on the River Kwai, mm-hmm. that's fine. But do it on purpose, because you are writing even up to the part about whistling as they walk into the
car. Yeah, yeah.
That's the part at which you go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen Bridge on the River Kwai, you should rent it right now.
It's clear this person has seen Bridge on the River Kwai.
If you have, remember everyone else has seen it too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like the names of places. New Portland tells you something about mm-hmm. what happened to Old Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And Shoulder Stone.
What a beautiful town. Yeah,
that's a really interesting name for a town.
Yeah.
Because something happened there. People put their shoulders to a stone there.
Yep. Yeah,
and there's a story there.
Really
so
nice.
It's very evocative. It's good paragraphs. It's good writing. But this is very evocative, if not directly referential or referring to actual events, the Bataan Death March in the Philippines.
Yep.
And an enormously famous movie called Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah.
And if that's your intention, that's fine. But make sure that that's your intention.
But I do like what you did with it. I will say that.
It's a fun to read.
It might be that now that you have all of this and you have sort of all of this information, I can see where you might just watch Bridge on the River Kwai and then decide to write four paragraphs and riff on it.
Yeah.
And then pull out the new stuff, the woman and the towns underground and the flooding perhaps and the exposure of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And start over again and leave out the Bridge on the River Kwai stuff and really talk about these characters and what they think and where they are and how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, using a movie as a way to sort of get through.
Jumpstart and get through
the writer's block and jumpstart your motivation to write is awesome.
Yeah.
And then you start to cull from that where your brain went in an original way, and it really can help you get a story started. So I'm all for that.
And keep these empire chaps.
Oh, yeah.
Because, boy, does that tell us who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. You're talking about the British Army.
Yep.
In some expeditionary force someplace that's not mm-hmm. in their own country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, great job, everyone.
Great job, Samuel. And
we have
thank
other
you.
Things to
we
go.
Have more going on next week. We'll
yes,
do more.
We do. Yes, we do. And we're still enjoying this, so we're going to keep right on doing it.
Yeah. And thank you, Driftglass.
I love you, baby.
I love you, too. Thank you. Bye.